It's my pleasure to welcome to the podium this afternoon Dr. Abdulkarim Shahid, a distinguished academic and well-known Islamic philosopher, who we have the very great pleasure and honor of having here this term at the University of Chicago as a Mellon visiting professor. And he is going to be addressing us this afternoon on the topic done and undone in, done and undone in religious reform in Iran. Please join me in reading.
Good afternoon, all. And thank you for coming. And I, as one of the contributors to the organization of this workshop, I feel obliged again to thank everybody who is here and the University of Chicago as well, and esteemed speakers, not including me, of course, excluding myself. Now, as announced, the title of my talk is Done and Undone in the Religious Reform in Iran, Post-Revolutionary Iran. This means, actually, which I'm going to speak about, achievements and challenges, the possible and the impossible in the religious reform that we had in Iran and any religious reform that might take place anywhere in the world or perhaps in Islamic land. Now, by way of a very brief introduction, may I remind you that what happened in Iran 33 years ago under the name of Islamic Revolution was not an Islamic conceptual reform. It was an Islamic identity reform. And that is mainly because of the personality of Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the leader of the revolution. Of course, before the revolution, we had some religious reformers whose name you hear here in this workshop, and I'm sure that you are familiar with, like Dr. Shariati, like Bazargan, Talaqani, Mutahhari, and many others, who were mainly engaged with Islam as a religion, as a set of beliefs and doctrines, and they were trying very hard in order to renew it, revise it, revisit it, and reform it somehow, conceptually and doctrinally. But for Ayatollah Khomeini, nothing was needed. And he thought that Islam was perfect and complete. And he was very frank and explicit on that in his lectures, which he delivered in Najaf before he came to Iran as the leader of the revolution. There he mentions very clearly to the seminarians, to the religious students, that we have got everything. What we need and we lack are the executive forces. So only we need some people to execute these Islamic laws and regulations. This is as far as laws, law is concerned. I mean, when it comes to theology, to philosophy, to theosophy, to mysticism and everything, I mean, they are out of question. If there is, I mean, at all, a place for reform in law, and making some ijtihad, there is no room anywhere to make ijtihad in theology or in philosophy and things like that, because they were absolutely perfect, and they needed nothing actually to be added to, and there were perhaps no deficiencies in none of those disciplines. Therefore, I would like to call Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini, as a Muslims reformer rather than an Islam reformer. He wanted to reform Muslims. And for him to reform Muslims, or the Islamic Ummah, if you like, meant to give them back their own dignity, their own honor. This was the concept which engaged the mind of Ayatollah Khomeini, right from the beginning to the end. He never thought that perhaps Islam needed any ijtihad, any reform, nothing like that. For him, everything was there, and we had a perfect legacy of prophet and imams. But what we did not have, and we lacked it badly, was the dignity, the honor, the independence, you know, and the courage, you know, to revolt against the oppressors and so on. So I would like to say that the Islamic revolution was a revolution of dignity against humiliation. That was at least the conception of Ayatollah Khomeini, a revolt of dignity against humiliation. It was not a cultural revolt. It was not a religious reform. That was not the case. Till the end of the life of Ayatollah Khomeini, that was absolutely the case. In all his sermons, if you go and read them, in all his writings, actually what he wrote before the revolution, what he wrote after the revolution, what is prominent everywhere is the idea of izzat, the dignity. So we are no longer aziz, we are no longer honorable and dignified. We are humiliated, and we have to do something about it, to do something against it. We have to revolt against it. Of course, who were the humiliators? Who were the people who brought this humility to Muslim nation? There were two main sources, the domestic despotism and the foreign imperialism, the foreign powers. So you might say that the Islamic revolution, again, at least in the conception of its leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, was a revolt, first against the domestic despotism, domestic tyranny of Shah, who was a puppet, a proxy of foreign powers, and then, of course, an anti-Western revolution. Ayatollah Khomeini usually did not use the word West, but what actually he used most was the word Ajanib, you know, which virtually meant the same, Ajanib, the foreigners. This, terminology of West and Westernization and all this, although he had no objection to, but he did not use it much. It was for the intellectuals and lay clerics, you know, to use it. But for him, as a grand Ayatollah, of course, that was not its terminology. I do remember that once Ayatollah Khomeini, in one of his sermons after the revolution, he said that Jalal al-Ahmad, the author of the book, The West Toxication, Gharb Zadegi, came to me after his release from the prison of Shah in 1963. And his book, Gharb Zadegi, was there on my desk. And he looked at it and asked me, do you read such rubbish as well? So Ayatollah Khomeini did read such rubbish, I mean, like Gharb Zadegi, but he never used the terminology. Anyway, I mean, in his conception, as far as I can understand, and I can say there are, you know, huge evidence to that, you might call the Islamic revolution, from the conception of its leader, first of all, a revolt of dignity over humiliation, and two sources of humiliation, the domestic tyranny and the foreign powers, who had taken Shah as their, you know, puppet, as their proxy, as their servant, and who was, you know, oppressing people with the help and support of foreigners. So this is what it is, I mean, as far as I can say. Therefore, Ayatollah Khomeini was not at all concerned with religious reform. That was nothing. That did nothing to him. Religious reform in the sense that we have to reform law, we have to reform theology, we have to reform morality, we have to reform philosophy, nothing of that sort. And never that appears in his writings, in his speeches, and never he encouraged anybody to do that, and he never welcomed, you know, religious reformers like Shariati, like Bazargan. From that point of view, they were unwelcome personalities for him. He did pay respects to them, of course, but not to Shariati, you know. But, you know, but he never made any disrespect to them. That was how what is. I do remember that during his whole life, long life, I mean, before the revolution and 11 years after the revolution, he never, never, you know, mentioned the name of Jamaluddin Asadabadi. Whereas Jamaluddin Asadabadi was an important predecessor to him, actually. I would say that Jamaluddin Assadabadi was also a reformer of the Muslim Ummah. Jamaluddin was not a religious reformer, conceptual reformer. That was not the case. And Khomeini, more or less, was on the same line, on the same frequency, but he never mentioned him. So, I mean, he was a very curious person, and he has his own mind and his own conceptions. And he ran the country, you know, according to his own understandings. But, and this is a very big but, it was left to people who were still Muslims, who were familiar with the modern world, and who loved their faith, and who were watching, you know, very closely the deficiencies of this religion. Because all what Shariati did, all what Mutahhari did, was before revolution. They were not able, you know, to watch Islam at work. They were just writing about Islam. They were writing about revolution. They were writing about reforming religion. But they had no power in order to implement, in order to apply reform. They had not, you know, they did not live enough in order to, you know, have an Islamic government and to watch, you know, the deficiencies and the shortcomings and things like that. And it was left to the intellectuals and the people after the revolution. Khomeini, as I said, was not much, you know, bothered with such ideas. So a group of people, of Muslims, both sensitive to modernity and to faith and to Islamic government and to justice, all this actually were somehow emerged, you know, somehow emerged, who are now called religious intellectuals. And religious reform actually was one of the products of this group called religious intellectuals. Now, therefore, religious intellectuals have got their own ancestry, their own predecessors like Shariati and others, but their experience of Islam, of religion, and of politics is very different from the experience of their, you know, people who came before them. There were a number of problems. Professor Tavakkoli mentioned here something that I would like to perhaps add a small correction to it. The term fiqh-e-puya was not mine, actually. The dynamic fiqh, it was not mine. To some extent, I didn't like it. And perhaps I wrote against it. You know, in the sense that fiqh-e-puya, of course, you know, first was introduced by people like Hijazi, like many others. And it was, you know, introduced in order perhaps to adjust the stagnant fiqh, the stagnant law. They thought that perhaps Islamic jurisprudence was very stagnant, very slow-moving, so it needed a push, and it was incumbent on fuqaha perhaps to make some new ijtihads and make fiqh more dynamic in order to meet the needs of the newly established Islamic society and government and so on. It was only the beginning, and that, of course, did not come from perhaps people like me. But what, you know, attracted my notice, my attention, was this, that immediately or after a very short time, I realized that although, I mean, a call for a dynamic fiqh was in its place, it was right, but it was not enough at all. Because in order to dynamize fiqh, you have to dynamize other sciences. You have to dynamize theology. You have to dynamize philosophy. You have to dynamize your understanding of history, of religion, of modernity, and many things. Therefore, mujtahids in the, you know, ordinary sense of the word, they are not able to dynamize fiqh. You know, they are not, because they do not have enough, you know, tools and instruments in their hands. Their theology is stagnant. Their philosophy is stagnant. Their understanding of modernity is stagnant or next to nothing. Therefore, they cannot apply any radical change to law and expecting the fuqaha, the jurist, I mean, from the top, like Ayatollah Khomeini, to the bottom, it's a false expectation. It's an expectation which will never materialize. So that was, of course, you know, a kind of a stimulus to me and some other people that, okay, we need to dynamize, to make law dynamic, but how? How? Is it a personal decision on the part of a jurist, of a faqih like Khomeini or any others to bring dynamism to fiqh, or perhaps it needs some other things? It is not a personal ijtihad, it's not a personal decision. We have to reshuffle, we have to revisit and make radical, drastic changes to some sciences and some disciplines which come prior to fiqh, and fiqh is in debt to them. Fiqh borrows its ideas and concepts from them, such as theology and so on, especially, and also linguistics, for example. So one, all these were unfolded, one by one. Therefore, after this realization, actually we embarked, me, myself, and my friends, actually, on various projects to perhaps dynamize theology or reform theology, perhaps to reform law and many other things. And that's what's how I used a geometrical term, reconstruction, perhaps, to reconstruct Islamic principles, teachings, and so on and so forth. So in trying to perhaps bring dynamism to fiqh and going back to other disciplines, eventually I came to the realization that perhaps we have to have a new look at the very concept of revelation, of the very concept of the sacred text, of the very concept of the interpretation of the sacred text, and all these things. And quite logically and naturally, all this became part of the project of the religious reform. Therefore, no wonder that you see that in Iran, for example, during the last 30 years, not only the law, which is the lowest sciences in science in Islamic sciences, but also theology, philosophy, linguistics, and hermeneutics, all these things are now being a subject of study. And our religious reformers, one by one, have taken them quite seriously in order to study them, in order to apply them, to our religious heritage. Now, this is religious reform. Therefore, a revolution which started off with a revolution in identity and dignity now is being continued by a revolution, if you like, or reform in religious concepts, in religious disciplines. And this is the, the most logical continuation of a religion. I may add, of course, here that religious reformers are not in favor of the government. They are not liked by the government. Therefore, when I say that it is a logical continuation of the Islamic revolution, it doesn't mean that in the conception of the people in charge of the country, who are running the country, they are beloved person. No. They are rejected person. They are somehow smuggling, themselves inside the society, and they are not, they do not have, the ordinary security that other people enjoy. So, but the idea is spreading anyway. And fortunately, there are many clients and customers to such ideas. And the future of these ideas, according to my prophecy, my prediction, is very bright. Because the commodity that the Qom Seminary and other seminaries, offer people is very old, is very outdated, to say the least, and together with some superstitions and so on. Therefore, the mission of the religious reformers is a very welcome mission in our changing, rapidly changing society. Now, just in order to put my finger on some of the achievements of the religious reform and then go on to some challenges on perhaps some of the projects which are still undone, I may, mention a few of them as far as the time allows me. And then, of course, during the course of question and answers. One of the, I was, you know, one of the members of the cultural committee for the Cultural Revolution, appointed by Ayatollah Khomeini. We had a number of things to do, to revise the curricula of universities and many other issues, cultural issues in the society. I remember that the Prime Minister was, and the Secretary for Higher Education, all of them were, you know, members of that committee, together with seven other members, and I was among them for a few years. I do remember very well that one of the problems which came up, you know, in those meetings was the, you know, a kind of polarity, if you like, or a kind of rivalry between national identity and religious identity. It is still with us, actually. It is still with us. And at that time, it was much more colorful, much more intense, you know, because it was an Islamic revolution, supposedly, and, you know, Milligarai or nationalism in the sense of going back to pre-Islamic era to revive it against Islam, for example. That was another, you know, conception which was there. Ayatollah Khomeini, as the leader of the revolution, was one of the, you know, the strongest enemies of Milligarai, of this kind of nationalism. So the rivalry, the competition between these two was at its high tide, you know, in the beginning years, in the early years of revolution. And we had discussion. There were, you know, calls in the society that Nowruz, as the, you know, New Year, I mean, it was, of course, an Iranian national New Year, this has to be replaced by one of the, I mean, feasts and religious things and so on. So that was the first thing that, you know, again, shook me. And I, you know, attracted my attention that, wow, things are happening in this country and in this society which will end up in some cultural disasters. So from early on, actually, I realized, and I wrote about this, that we Iranians, we are carriers or heirs, if you like, of three different cultures: Islamic culture, religious culture, national culture, and Western culture. Because already from the, let us say, a century ago or more than that, we had a serious encounter with the Western culture, and we borrowed many things from them: science, technology, humanities, politics, and so on. So Western culture is a very well-established subculture in Iran, as well as Islamic culture, which of course means our religion, Shi'i culture, and then of course the national Iranian culture. As far as I understood, and my reading of history tells me, and I actually conveyed it to others, these three cultures are to live together, have to have a peaceful coexistence. Trying to dominate one of them over others will, you know, produce disaster in our country. It was the aim of Reza Shah in our country to, I mean, the father of the last Shah, to predominate, you know, the nationalistic culture over to others. It was the, you know, in the time of Shah, the last Shah, it was the Western culture. And under the Ayatollah Khomeini, they wanted to dominate, you know, Islamic culture above all other cultures. This is impossible. This is unmaterializable. So it was one of the first projects of Islamic or religious reform to remind people that these three subcultures have to live peacefully together, and we should not try, none of them, to dominate over others. Of course, I mean, each one of these needed, you know, cleaning, needed criticism. Islamic culture, you know, already is full of superstitions, of nationalistic boasts are sometimes not in its place. And Western culture, of course, has got the negative and the positive side. So everything, of course, should come under the criticism. But nevertheless, trying to eradicate, trying to remove one of them, perhaps to dominate one over two others, has been, actually has proved impossible, has proved disastrous, and therefore ousting national culture, national festivities, and so on, in order to replace them by the religious one was a very, ugly decision to be made. And actually, I warned the prime minister at that time, who is now actually under house arrest in Iran, unfortunately. And I am happy that to some extent it was accepted. Although now there are some clerics now after 30 years who are singing the same song, unfortunately. And they would like, you know, again to bring up the same issue. Now, the second thing that I think religious reformers were responsible in a positive sense, and they made something which I would say that before the revolution it was unthinkable. And that unthinkable, a la Professor Akun, that unthinkable is this. Everybody knows here, and when I had my last lecture here, there were so many Baha'is, compatriots of my country here, and they had a lot of complaints about the situation in Iran and so on. But one thing is clear now, that Baha'is now are considered to be citizens in Iran. This is a very important thing. This is the pluralism. This is the inclusivism that was preached, you know, and propagated by religious reformers in Iran. It was absolutely impossible and unthinkable before the revolution to talk about Baha'is and to call for their freedom, to call for citizenship, and for them to be allowed, you know, to have their own families, their own schools, and so on. Not only religious reformers, but actually one of the grand ayatollahs, Ayatollah Muntaziri, actually he himself wrote about them, and from that high authority, you know, such a fatwa was really appreciable, that he made the case for Baha'is to say that they are, after all, citizens of Iran. They are not to be persecuted because of their religion, because of their beliefs, and so on. I'm not saying that Baha'is now are very well treated in Iran now. It is not yet the case. But their situation is much, much, much far better than what it used to be. And this was because of this idea of inclusivism, idea of pluralism, that now is prevailing, fortunately, in Iran, and it's finding its way among masses. The other thing, you know, is the idea of rights. I quite remember that from the early, again, years after the revolution, I was thinking about the Islamic State, the Islamic government as it is in Iran, and trying to pinpoint, you know, what were the differences between such a state, such a government, and a secular government. So eventually I came to the conclusion that the pivotal concept that make a real difference between a religious state and a non-religious state or a secular state is the very concept of rights. A religious state is based on the concept of obligation. And indeed, it is a language of religion everywhere. It is a language of obligation. Whereas the language of modern secularity is a language of rights. This is now very well recognized. But I am glad that towards the end of his life, Ayatollah Muntaziri came to the same realization. And he added a phrase to what he said, which is quite, quite telling. He said one of the shortcomings of our activities was, I mean, Ayatollah Muntaziri says, that we did not pay much attention to the idea of rights. This is the first confession. The second confession, which is much more important, is that if we allow rights to make their way into the fiqh, the whole fiqh will be radically changed, will be a different fiqh altogether. And I do remember that he said, Ayatollah Muntaziri, to one of his students, that you go and do it. You go and do it. Introduce the idea of rights into fiqh and actually pick up the fruits. I am not able to do it because, after all, for 80 years, I have been doing traditional classical fiqh. I cannot change it. This is my main commodity. This is my sole, you know, business. So I cannot change it, but you can change it. This realization on the part of a grand Ayatollah is priceless. Really, it's priceless. All this tells you none of such things were in the mind of Ayatollah Khomeini. He was very clear of all this, very innocent. I mean, he never thought about none of these things. For him, the idea of rights, the idea of, secular politics, none of such things actually crossed his mind. Now, the third thing which I would like to mention, because I am overpassing my limits, is the fiqh itself. You know, this is my motto, has been my motto always, that a fat fiqh means a thin morality, and a fat morality means a thin fiqh. This is my recognition of this thing. This is not my recognition. This is the religious reformers' recognition. This has got a long history, actually. When you go to Al-Ghazali 900 years ago, virtually this is what he says. And when he says, and he writes about the religious reformism or religious revivalism, what he says, I mean, his famous motto is this: all religious sciences are in decline, alas, except Sufism and morality, which is completely dead. So this is the recognition of Al-Ghazali in his writing. This is 900 years ago. Now, I would like, and I wish Ghazali were alive in nowadays, what would have he said, you know. I would say that in our day, yes, fiqh is so fat that has made morality so thin, so slim, you know, which is perfectly next to nothing. Virtually next to nothing. So one of the tasks of religious reformers was, first of all, to realize this disease, this illness, and then to remedy it. By what? By, expanding morality, inflating it in the positive sense, and actually limiting and contracting fiqh, you know, because fiqh has become everything. This was, let me remind you, ask for mercy of God for the soul of Mehdi Bazargan. He was, you know, as far as I remember, the first person who, reminded us of the cancerous growth of fiqh in Islam and in Shiism, cancerous growth. That was his expression, which is a very meaningful expression. And I think it was a very apt, you know, recognition of an important disease. So morality now means the heart of religiosity. Fiqh is not the heart of religiosity. Therefore, in order to revive religion, it means you have to revive morality. Now, this brings me to one of the challenges to religious reformism, and this will be my last point. This challenge is exactly about morality. Okay, let me remind you. We, in the history of Islam, in the history of Islamic culture, very grossly and very broadly, one can say that we had two systems of ethics: religious ethics and Sufi ethics. Okay, forget about the Greek ethics. That is not, really part of Islamic culture. And nobody actually became a moral person by pursuing Greek, morality, Greek, dictums and so on. No. Books like Ibn Miskaway or Akhlaq al-Nasiri, they are so, first of all, incomprehensible for the layman, and therefore, history shows that nobody actually did read them in order to become a moral person. Yes, in order to be a knowledgeable person, in order to have, informations about Greek philosophy, yes, you may read them. but not from the point of view of morality. But books like Al-Ghazali's Kimya al-Sa'adah wa Hiya al-Ulum and many others who has been written on his model has been very influential, very impactful, books in the history of Islamic culture as well as religious. Now, what is a religious morality? Very briefly mentioned, it is based on Quran. And what is the morality of Quran? It is a morality of fear. It is very important, a morality of fear and warriorship, jihad. So a moral person, according to the Quran, is a person who is fearful of God, full of fear, if you like, and, of course, a warriorship, personality. So most of what you see in the Quran and in the Prophet's saying about morality is a morality of someone who is ready all the time, who's alert all the time in order to fight against the enemies of Islam. Now, this warriorship has got its own requirements. First of all, you have to have less and less attachments, less and less belongings, and this means a kind of asceticism, a kind of mild asceticism. Tawakkul, for example, and you are absolutely, you put your trust in God in order to be victorious, in order to help you and support you. Many of what you find in the early Islamic morality and ethics is a morality of warriorship and fear of God. Let me remind you that even justice, which is the supreme concept in Greek ethics, you wouldn't find it in Islamic morality. Justice is subordinate to taqwa. Taqwa, the fear of God, is on the top. اعدلوا هو أقرب للتقوى. Be fearful of God. Sorry, be just. That is something which brings you closer to taqwa, makes you a man of taqwa, of fear, and of shame, and so on. So this is the, very briefly putting it, the Islamic. But then you come to the Sufi, morality. Sufi morality as embodied in what Ghazali wrote is not very different from purely Islamic, but nevertheless its emphasis on some concepts and some principles is different from the emphasis of traditional Islamic ethics. For example, the concept of courage, bravery, does not come up in Sufi literature. Does not come up in Sufi, in Al-Ghazali writings, for example. Because that is not part of the Sufi morality. In Sufi morality, you have got submission, you have got taslim, you have got fear, or perhaps love, as it is, as you find it in Rumi, and so on. Now, this I mention in order to give you the geometry of morality in the past, and or perhaps the geography of morality in the past and in the present. But in the present, the geography or the geometry of morality has become very different. And this is a real, real challenge for any religious reform, including Islamic reform. On the one hand, the idea and the concept of rights, is there, which was not there in the past. It was there, of course, but it was, a minor concept. Everywhere you encountered your obligations. And rights were very slim, as you know. So on the one hand, we have got this very idea of rights. And don't take it, lightly. It's very important. Because some of the, very clear immoralities have become moral under the banner and under the concept of rights. Isn't it the case? One of the clear immoralities of the past was, for example, adultery. But it is not a right of a woman, to have affairs with someone else. When I say it is moral, I'm saying that it is not, illegal. There is no punishment for it. It is permissible anyway. Or homosexuality, for that matter, it was absolutely an immoral act, even 20, 30 years ago here and under any religious culture whatsoever. But now, because of the concept of rights, it has become permissible. So this is a real challenge. I mean, the idea of rights is a very real challenge to morality nowadays. And of course, the idea of obligations, which are there, and modernity. Now, we cannot, you know, have the same morality as we had. Not a mere morality which is based on fear or love, or a morality of warriorship, or a morality like a Sufi morality. You know, geometrizing, if you like, engineering a new morality is a real, real challenge, you know, to Islamic reform. There are many other things which I have to skip because of the time limitation. Thank you for your listening. Thanks very much.